Right, so this fourth session in this part two is titled Where Aquinas Goes Devastatingly Wrong. My notes are intentionally shorter today because I will probably go on some rants. But rants that I trust are in concert with the notes. And I think hopefully draw some helpful pictures too. This is where we're going to start parting ways with Thomas Aquinas. Don't feel bad. We'll come back to him next week when we come to the subject of law. So I wanted to end on that note and not on this, just to be positive. But we do have to cover this because he does get this wrong. And in seeing how he gets this wrong, we're going to trace a line that goes through his wrong thinking, not from his wrong thinking, because there was a pattern going wrong already in the history of the Roman Catholic Church. But by the 13th century, what Thomas does is he gives a language. He gives a theoretical justification to a combination of things that were already there. A worldview, I would call it a worldview that I would just call Romanism. And I don't have time to go into that right now because this is not a class on Roman Catholicism or church history. Wow. At least I caught it. Romanism plus a growing humanism that comes to full fruition in the Italian Renaissance. But there you just have this, maybe I guess you could call it a regurgitation of original classical Greek humanism. And those two things together, along with the language that Aquinas is going to give them, creates the problems that the reformers are going to react to. So this just gives a full theoretical justification or a lingo to a problem that was already there before the 13th century. So I've broken the outline into three parts: sin, grace, and sacraments. I'm going to spend the most amount of time on sin, almost as much time on grace, and then very little on the sacraments, just because we're going to treat this philosophically and go back to the control rooms, go back to the roots, and see, you got to see this first. Once you cover how he views sin, you'll see why he does what he does with grace, and then that'll just make perfect sense of how this idea of cooperative grace and then finally meritorious grace, which is the ultimate square circle in our everyday experience, you'll see where it comes from. Here's the big idea. The big idea, and this is going to be sort of a punchline big idea at the very end of it, but the big idea is that meritorious grace is the greatest contradiction ever held by a great thinker. Meritorious grace is the greatest contradiction ever held by a great thinker. This is a perfect example of how Pascal's view of human nature, that man is great and man is a worm at the same time. We're a mass of contradictions. This is exactly where Pascal's maxim comes home to roost, because who contributed more to logic after the medieval world developed more, the classical world, from a Christian conception than Thomas Aquinas? And yet, no greater and more devastating contradiction was ever held than this idea of meritorious grace. So, let's start to look at sin to see where he brings in grace the way he does. Thomas's doctrine of sin is divided into its nature, its causes, its effects, and its division. He's going to explore all of that as far as sin. He's going to define it. He's going to show its causes and its effects. And he's going to then subdivide it into a couple of fairly famous categories in Catholic theology. But let's go to nature first. One thing we didn't get a chance to cover when we talked about Thomas's doctrine of man is the idea of the dispositions of man. And let's do it like this. Let's remember that any particular thing, and in this case it's a man, any man, has a substantial nature, that's inside this circle, that is what the thing is, and then has accidents. Now, only God doesn't have any accidental properties or attributes, but if you take any created thing, and that's why substantial is rightly a darker color here, because in a created thing, if you start taking away all the accidental properties, eventually you don't have anything left, because it does not belong to a created thing simply to be, whereas for God, He is in pure actuality. So we've covered all that. But when we got to man, one of the things we didn't cover about this was the idea of dispositions. A disposition is like the closest you can get to of accidental properties. So I'm going to draw it in the shape kind of emanating from the circle. I'm going to draw it in the same shape as the circle because a disposition is the thing most natural to a man that's not the actual idea of man itself. Think of it as disposition, a position of the soul. Disposed in a certain way. You could even use the word inclined in a certain way, I suppose. But it's let's think of it this way. Primary or chief among the accidental properties. A disposition of man. Now, here's why this is going to be important. Because Aquinas divides disposition into two things. Number one, habit. And I almost don't even want to put number two because it's almost a subdivision of habit. Virtue. And then I'll put in parentheses its opposite, vice. So I'll have that on the board. Let me just sort of start to unpack this and why it matters to what he does with sin. So a disposition, think of it as a more permanent state of being. I say more permanent and not most permanent. It is proper to the being of a man, but it's not absolutely necessary. In other words, if you have this disposition instead of that, you don't cease to be a man in total. Now, among such dispositions, as I said, are habits and virtues. So here's a definition of a habit. A habit we would recognize as a pattern of action. I think that's a definition that I think we would agree with. A habit or is a pattern of action. While a virtue we would recognize as a moral excellence in action. So think of a habit as... Now I'm going to erase this. This is man. So let's erase this for a second. Let's draw the circle. And inside the circle we'll put habit. So let's put any pattern of action. But notice that it's a created being. It has to be activated. Okay? From outside of itself. Now within that, there are moral habits. Those moral habits which are excellent, which are naturally perfecting of this kind of a being, we would call a virtue. And again, that has to be acted upon by something outside of itself. Losing all my chalk on the floor. So, Thomas is going to borrow from the Greeks, and particularly Aristotle, on this point. In their ethics, in their psychology, they put a lot of emphasis on habituation. And that's not a foreign idea to the scriptures. So we're going to have to do some fine tooth comb scalpel stuff here. Because there's some ideas here that are biblical as far as they go, but they're taken out of their context. So let's define habituation as the fixing of a pattern of action to the shape of a soul. The fixing of a pattern of action to the shape of the soul. So I'm becoming more courageous by performing acts of courage. That's kind of the way Aristotle would say it. By habituation, we become the virtue or the vice in question. Now, habit implies potency, since its patterns shape the subject, change the subject. And since in God there is no potentiality, it follows that God cannot have habits. Now it follows from what Aquinas has said about the end of man and about good and evil that no habit is morally neutral. So he's going to agree with us on that. No habit is morally neutral. From this it follows that a virtue must be nothing other than a good habit, an activity or a range of activities which are morally enhancing to the soul or morally perfecting of the soul. I would say to Thomas, yes. And, for that same reason, a vice is one that is not morally neutral and therefore has a disastrous shape on the soul. Maybe a decisively disastrous, say for example, maybe Adam's sin. Okay, so remember that. We don't disagree with this chart. We would just say that you got to follow through. And so there's going to be an order flip-flop. So just, there's the first chart. There's the first thing just to give you a little bit of grammar of how Aquinas handles habit and virtue and stuff like that. Now, he's going to use vice to mean the opposite of virtue. He's going to define it in light of its opposite. As Aristotle said, quote, virtue is a disposition of a perfect thing to that which is best. And by perfect, I mean that which is disposed according to its nature. So, in light of that, what could a vice be but the opposite to this perfection? Something which opposes me becoming what I was meant to be. That's a vice. Again, no disagreement there. But I think what has happened, and when I say has, I mean between the classical era and by this point in the 13th century, is that these words are used so interchangeably, so long, and so loosely with two biblical words. So I'm going to put above this line, Christian, and below this line, merely classical or pagan, even pagan at their best. And I'm going to put above this line, under Christian, sorry, let me do the pure first. Holiness, and then to the right, sin. That's above the line. And below the line, under classical, I'm going to put virtue corresponding to holiness and vice corresponding to sin. And I think what happened, in my view, is that when these are used so interchangeably, so loosely, for so long, they can bleed into each other in a way that sort of moves away from biblical definitions. So, each thing is designed to speak about the God of perfection in proportion to its nature. So in this case, it's the nature of man. So these are the classical words that are used for what the Bible would simply call sin over against personal holiness. Now here I just mean personal holiness because we're just talking about the perfection of this being, namely man. So we're not yet even talking about the holiness of God. But Thomas finds the distinction between vice and sin useful because one of them is the essence in habit, and that's vice. And the other is an example in act, and that's sin. So what's going to happen here, I'm going to have to erase this to get to a new board. And on this board, I'm going to compare what Thomas is going to be saying to, for lack of a better picture, the Puritan picture of sin, which I think is the biblical picture. And let's put man going this way, left to right, and then just to get a second chart going. And on Thomas's view, let's just put Paul. Let's just be arrogant and claim we know the Bible. Let's just do it like that. So in Thomas's view, what you have here is particular sins leading to vice, because vice is going to be treated as the universal. So remember, habituation. By these particular sins, I'm going to become a vicious person. Well, I don't disagree with that. But the Puritans would really stress that by sin, I sin. Now, they're going to mean more than that. Okay, but I'm going to have to keep using biblical words here to keep showing how this procession happens. Because obviously, if you think of Romans 5, by one man's sin, you got a sinner here. And sinners typically sin. They're sin factories. Okay? Now, don't jump ahead. Thomas is going to agree that you need grace first. He and Roman Catholic theology, at least officially, is actually closer to the Bible on this and closer to Augustine against Pelagius than most of evangelicals today. So don't jump ahead and make his problem too big too quickly. See it, see the trajectory first. So, on this point, he's following Aristotle and following the Greeks in that particular actions lead to corresponding habits. And that's true. But that's only one side of the coin. So here's how he says it. He says, now one virtuous act does not cause a virtue, as stated above. And consequently, one sinful act does not corrupt virtue. He's going to mean that in a particular way, but the problem is if he doesn't guard against the other, he's going to have a blind spot in his mind because one sinful act does corrupt virtue. Adam, Romans 5, you know. Therefore, they can be together in the same subject. So, vice, virtue, sin, holiness, sinful act, virtue, they can be together in the same subject. Well, if you say it like that, no doubt the sinful nature and a virtuous act can coexist. And a regenerate man will constantly be sinning. The two go together down here in this lifetime. Luther would say much the same thing. So if you read Aquinas charitably here, he might be saying that sin is not incompatible with virtue in the sense of coexistence. They coexist down here in one person. Not that sin is not utterly opposed to virtue in the sense of impropriety. The problem, we have to be very specific about where we see the problem, because if we just see this massive, he's going wrong, then we're not going to pinpoint, we're not going to be good surgeons of this apostasy. And there is an apostasy going on here. Here's the problem. It's the order of cause that is troubling from a biblical perspective. It's the order of cause. We've got to drive our scalpel in here and see, speaking of the word devastating, we use that in the title, it does seem that people like Francis Schaeffer and others, their criticism of Aquinas is valid, but not about natural theology, which we spoke of in the early weeks. Aquinas does baptize grace into nature, or make nature, this is the way Schaeffer said it, nature began to eat up grace. Absolutely true criticism of Aquinas. Here's where it happens, though, in his doctrine of sin. For Aquinas, the fall was not devastating enough. He did not see the devastatingness. I didn't have the notes on this part. I'm just kind of going off the cuff here. He didn't see how devastating it was in terms of how sin causes sin. So, we're going to need a fine scalpel here. Thomas correctly distinguishes, for example, between the sin of commission and the sin of omission. Thomas is going to make three distinctions about sin, all of which are famous, and two of which are correct, as far as they go. So here's the first of those three distinctions. Let's put omission first, actually. The sin of omission versus the sin of commission. I can never spell these words right. I think I got it, though. I don't know. I think one is two M's and one is one M for no reason at all. Or for some reason at all. The English. Ask us later. Ask Doug later about English. Crazy stuff. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that's right. But the sin of commission versus the sin of omission. So he further dissects why omitting what we ought to do implies that we are, in fact, acting. See, people like to opt out here. As a side note, people like to think that when they're not doing what they ought to do, therefore they're opting out. Oh, no, I just opt out of that. No, I just don't have anything to say about it. I'm neutral, like Switzerland. No, there's no such thing. If God calls you to do it and you're not, that's the sin of omission. In fact, there's a priority given to that. So Aquinas shows that if we omit what we ought to do, we are in fact committing something. He says, quote, "For there is no sin of omission unless we omit what we can do or not do." That's going to be a scalpel there. So I'm going to agree with this distinction, but something just got smuggled in there. I'll show you in a second. He says, now if this cause be not in man's power, in other words, to do or to not do that particular thing, the omission will not be sinful. In other words, if he's not even given to do that thing, well, then it's not even a sin of omission. As when anyone omits going to church on account of sickness, end quote. Interesting example. I'll agree with that as far as the words go, but here, there's an equivocation that goes on. I'm going to have to draw this on the board, because there's an inverse relationship that's being implied between the power in your nature to do something. So let's put over here, again, the soul. The power in my nature. And let's take the example of seeing. Remember a couple weeks ago we talked about the rock not being blind. We don't call rocks blind, and we don't say to rocks, bad rock, you should know better. Why? Because rocks are not seeing and knowing things. Okay? So a rock is not guilty of the sin of omission in not reading a book or looking at a sunrise, because a rock is not a seeing thing. So Aquinas sees an inverse relationship between the power in my nature to do something and then the sinfulness of omitting the thing, thereby actually committing it. And I agree with this distinction and this flowchart. But there's an equivocation that happened, if you caught it. In order to omit or commit, I have to have the ability to do or to do not. Do you recognize that definition from anything? Libertarian free will. Which Aquinas is not going to have this goofy romantic idea about the way we do in the modern world. Nevertheless, he's going to equivocate the word power here. Or at least he's going to beg the question about the original nature versus the sinful nature. Now, if he's talking about the rock, I agree with him. The rock is not a seeing thing. But if he's talking, in other words, a rock, when we talk about a rock falling, we're talking about the law of gravity, but the rock did not participate in the same way Adam did in the fall of man. So a rock before the fall, as far as I know, was not a seeing thing. The rock after the fall is not a seeing thing. But man and his sight has been affected by the fall. So, biblical principle there in that spectrum, if you're talking about the rock. Not so for human beings. Because human beings are seeing things. So the equivocation is going to be over the concept of nature. And in particular, the sinful nature over against the original nature. So this is a crucial thing right here. Maybe I'll put it over there on that part of the board. Because I don't want to erase my chart because I've got to make two more distinctions.
Yeah.
Yes. But what he means by it, I'd have to ask more questions, because he's going to explicitly take the side of Augustine against both Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism. It's weird. The more we look into this, the more we see how accurate Roman Catholic theology is about the outer realm of grace versus nature, as opposed to modern evangelical theology. It's more in the more we study this, the more we realize, the more we'll be tempted, if we're not reformed, to say, man, that's a really nitpicky distinction about the righteousness part that's coming up. But let me draw this out, because it's an interesting question. So let's put original nature here on the left, and let's put sinful nature over here. He's begging the question about the power in my nature and therefore the corresponding guilt. Okay? The right view would be over here. In my original nature, I ought to. In this case, remember what was the command? To see. To see. I ought to see. Well, guess what? Now, I cannot. Must I still see? In other words, am I not still bound to see? Yes. In my original nature, I ought to. Why? Because of my original nature as an end in itself? No. Because of who God is. God commands sight because He is perfect and beautiful to look at. That's why I ought to see. So now that I find out that I cannot see, is it not true that I still ought to see? I still ought to see. Why? Because God is still so beautiful to look at. My ability is not the basis that God looks at and says, all right, thou shalt not kill. Or not carve any graven images. Let's see what they can handle. Not the case. Here is where Thomas ingests Pelagianism, and he can't even see it. Because he explicitly agrees with Augustine against Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism. Aquinas explicitly believes in predestination, believes in election, believes in special grace preceding anything you can do, even the slightest belief. Aquinas would have rejected Arminianism in total at that outer layer. Okay? So let's press on. Let's keep looking at this. Whereas the Reformers would say that God commands according to His holiness, intended for the original nature, Aquinas shows himself to be affected by humanism at this point, making God command according to nature purely and simply with no distinction between the rock's non-eyes and our eyes. He begs the question. What is important in virtue and vice is that man ought to have the power to do or to do not. Well, I agree, man versus rock. So the word power, and so therefore the word nature, have now been equivocated. Without question, essential man does have the power to see what he ought to, and thus the command, because he ought to see. Yet sinful man does not have the power to see what he ought to, in spite of the command. In fact, Aquinas even contradicts his own system at this very point. You remember about natural law. If a deviation does not disprove the objective nature, remember we looked at triangles, rocks, squirrels, and then the three-legged cat. Deviations do not disprove the objective nature, rather they prove it. If that's true, then the divine command to essential humanity cannot be disproven any more than the three-legged cat can disprove that cats are four-legged beasts. So in the same way, man is still a seeing thing, and therefore is commanded to see. Not on the basis of whether or not he has gouged out his eyes, but purely on the basis of God making human eyes to see. Does everybody see the distinction there? Man is still a seeing thing. The fact that we have gouged out our eyes in Adam does not disprove the eye. It proves it. And so Aquinas' doctrine of sin utterly contradicts his doctrine of natural law. Period. And at that point, even though on the outside, no, he can check the box. If you were to go to if the only churches in town nowadays were the Reformed Church and the Roman Catholic Church, and the Roman Catholic Church, they were all reading Aquinas and not the Scriptures. Let's say that hypothetically. Not that they're reading Aquinas either, but let's just say there's the only two games in town. If you went just by their flashy website and our flashy website, because that's what you go by nowadays, they would check the box that says, no, I'm against Pelagianism, and by the way, I'm against semi-Pelagianism too. You hook them up to a lie detector test, they would mean it. They'd pass. We've got to be more, inquisitive to get at the root of the problem. All right. Well, Aquinas makes two more distinctions between kinds of sin that are going to be of special interest. One is spiritual versus carnal sins, and the other is mortal versus venial sin. Spiritual versus carnal. And when we finally see what he means by this, you can salvage some stuff from it, for sure, that's biblical. But then this one right here, mortal versus venial sins. And if you're wondering, original, he agrees with that, but one wonders how much he agrees with Augustine as much as he thought he agreed with Augustine. But at any rate, here's the principle for these two. All sins, he says, take their species from their objects. In other words, I define them by the object they're looking at, by the idol that they are pursuing. And since pleasure is twofold, of the soul and of the body, therefore it follows that there are sins of the soul, that's spiritual sin, and sins of the body, that's carnal sin. Now, interestingly, he holds, citing Gregory the Great on this point, that carnal sins are of less guilt because more shame carnal sin is of less guilt, but is of more shame than spiritual sins. And there, all he means by shame is out there. So he is calling us to a particular truth, namely, we think of these as so bad. So if I commit adultery, or if I murder someone, that's out there, and we might blush at that, and the whole world might point at us and say, sinner. Whereas, somebody who can control that, but is raging with pride, that's worse, but in the world we would call the other worse. Okay. So that part of his distinction is right. But I think it was Thomas Watson. It was at least one Puritan. There's another side of this coin that you should see. I think it was Watson. But his point was that we should also see a special shame in these too, because if we're going to call these the little sins by comparison, and there's a biblical truth in that, but the flip side of the coin is that if we're willing to desert Christ for food, gluttony, or for a little peep show, or whatever else, actually there's infinite shame in that, because we're willing to dump someone of infinite value for something that we're even admitting is of next to no value at all. Okay, so there's two sides of the coin there. Now, his distinction would seem to be true if what it meant is the inward disposition against God in the heart of pride, for example. Because a carnal sin, every one of them, includes the spiritual, proving that the spiritual sin is actually the root, even if it is unseen in the depths of the heart. So, on this point, he's going to be telling us something that's actually quite important. I don't think it's the whole thing, I think there's more to it, but certainly this is the root, so let's label this one and this two, just like we labeled this one and this two. The sins of omission issue forth into these, the spiritual sins on the inside issue forth into this. Jesus even said so in Mark 8, it is out of the heart. So this is the root. So this order, in and of itself, fine. That's right. Thomas is absolutely right about that. That's an important truth. Now, as to the most famous designation of sin that he made, which marks the church's sacramental grace, there is original, mortal, and venial. Now, original sin is so named because it was that sin of our original parents, Adam and Eve, and was transmitted to the rest of the human race. Now, on this point, on original sin, back here, you're better off listening to Augustine, if you want somebody to read, and of course, Jonathan Edwards and the Puritans as well. So let's leave that aside. Mortal sin. Mortal sin is so named because it leads to death. Morte in the Latin, death. Venial sin, not so much. That's a good definition. So let's do this. Let's put up a little chart, stick figure man. And inside the head, which will just represent the soul, we'll put spiritual, which we did already. And then carnal, let's put out here at the arm, issuing forth into the fingers, for example. So let's do that as a setup. And then, let's add to that, venial sin. This time we're going to put it on the body. Let's put it on the leg just to represent it is a physical demonstration of something. Something that we would recognize to be a vice in some way. But it doesn't necessarily lead to death. Now, down here, let's put a cliff beyond his foot and put two. And we'll put the word mortal sort of trickling down there. In fact, the phrase that is used in Catholic theology is making a shipwreck of your soul. Okay, so let's call that mortal sin. Now, examples of mortal sin would be murder and adultery. And examples of venial sin would be idle words and excessive laughter. Sorry, that was a little excessive right there. But you notice it's a little bit of a potential contradiction here between these two setups. Because if carnal sin is not as bad, is more shame here, and you have venial sin doing that, it does raise some questions there. And then again, look at that first setup that we did. What leads to what? This could lead to that, but the question is, you know, at what point? And on the basis of what? Is it something in here? Or is it something out there? So some problems can start to emerge right away. Now, as far as mortal sin and venial sin, is it even a biblical distinction? Here's one interesting thing about it, his definition. Thomas, according to him, mortal sin cannot exist in the sensual part of man, but only in the reason. Because only reason makes our inordinate ends. In other words, makes our what Augustine called our concupiscence, our inordinate or lust, desiring something outside of God. Well, again, in terms of the root versus the fruit, I'll agree with that. What I'm going to disagree with, and I think what all the reformers disagree with, is the very setup of mortal versus venial sin. Because I think, again, what's happening here? Sin is being defined down. Even if you have the right order in these setups, the whole thing is being defined such that there are particular sins that won't necessarily, what? Kill you? Okay, that's horribly and obviously unbiblical. So, he sounds a little Augustinian at some points here, but only so much. According to Calvin, in Book 2 of the Institutes, he talks about mortal versus venial sin being an absurd distinction. And according to his theory, it was designed in order to allow an easier way out for the satisfaction of some sins, which, by suggestion, was done for the purpose of empowering the church over against the laity. An easier way out for the satisfaction of some sins. And that is just a step toward deluding oneself into believing that one has not committed the most serious sins. Okay, to have that scale at all. So, huge section on sin, short sections now, because you got to understand what he means by sin to understand where the problem is going to start to really emerge. So, grace. As I said, Aquinas believed in predestination, and he believed that Augustine was right in his controversy with Pelagian and semi-Pelagian heresies. In other words, he believed that grace must precede every ounce of the new nature. But as we will see, it is grace from the working of the works. So, let's erase this, and we're going to start to see two things. We're going to start to see where the problem really starts to emerge. But as we do, you're going to notice something that will devastate everything you know about modern Christianity. Some people in this room already know this, so that won't be too dramatic. But one of the things you're going to see, here we go, let's draw three circles. One representing Augustine, let's call it an Augustinian, Calvinistic conception, which I would just say would be the biblical one, but let's just play along. Another one we'll call the Roman Catholic. So that circle just to the right, being more modern than the historic biblical view. And then thirdly, all the right of the right, let's just call this modern evangelical. One, two, three. The circle will represent the whole of our soteriology. In other words, our doctrine of salvation. Flowing from 10 o'clock down into the circle is going to be grace. Now, what needs to be saved? Someone with a nature. So inside the circle, let's put nature. Grace, 10 o'clock in every circle. Nature, within the circle, all three circles. Now, the arrow. In the same color, orange, to show the initial thing. In the Augustinian, Calvinistic, historic position, grace will flow down into nature with the numbers 1, grace, 2 down here. In the Roman Catholic view, grace will flow down into nature in exactly the same way, 1 and 2. In the modern evangelical view, nature is the cause of grace. This is at first glance. Rome is going to betray this. They're going to speak out of both sides of their mouth. However, and that's where we're going to nail the Roman Catholic view as a false gospel. But don't drop this first. We'll come back to this later. What you're going to see as you see this is that the distinctions are so fine. Now, they're going to make such a world of difference. But you have to go in there with a scalpel to see it. And once you do, you're going to see that this over here is much further from the biblical worldview than Roman Catholicism is. And those who study this see that, and those who don't see it because they haven't studied it. Period, end of story. All right. So let's move on. This is going to be a working of the works. We'll come back to that Latin phrase, ex opere operata. Because that's what's going to reverse the order. But Aquinas is going to make an initial distinction that will help us see it between operative grace and cooperative grace. So let's put up here, next to this first grace, operative. The efficient cause. Rome agrees with the Reformers and Augustine that grace has to be the operative, efficient cause for everything in salvation. And he meant everything. Unlike modern evangelicalism, which rejects that first and most important part of the biblical gospel. They agree. Now Aquinas is going to add, down here, cooperative grace. And here's how he says it. Quote, "For the operation of an effect is not attributed to the thing moved, but to the mover. Hence, in that effect in which our mind is moved and does not move itself, but in which God is the sole mover, grace alone," totally agree, "the operation is attributed to God. And it is with reference to this that we speak of operating grace. But in that effect in which our mind both moves and is moved, the operation is not only attributed to God, but also to the soul. And it is with reference to this that we speak of cooperating grace." Now, none of the reformers would have disagreed with that language if he would have further reserved the term operative to that grace. Let me erase this now so I can have room to write. If he would have just said further that this thing that I mean by operative grace is that grace which justifies. And this that I call cooperative grace, he moves me, I move. By my motion, he moves further, and so on. There's more grace to be had. If he would have reserved that for what we would call sanctification, the reformers and Aquinas would be absolutely at one. If by operative grace he meant Romans 3:25 and are justified by grace as a gift, and then down here, Philippians 2:12, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Work out your salvation. For it is God who works in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. If Aquinas would have meant that, the reformers would have no dispute. But he didn't. Precisely what Rome did not do. Instead, operative, being still primary to cooperative, nevertheless got the ball rolling. But which rolling ball or soul began to develop gracious habits as opposed to sinful habits? Remember, habits as a disposition. What's needed are gracious habits. Amen. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. I agree completely. He elected us to be holy, Ephesians 1:4. But, well, before we get into the rest of that sentence, but, what about the ability of the sinner to cooperate with God's grace? In other words, what did Thomas hold about the freedom of the will under sin? Well, in the Institutes, in Part 2, Section 2, Calvin says of Thomas's view on the free will, only that it says too little. He agrees that it is intellect and inclination. But where does he relate the will to the operation of grace? Aquinas says, it is characteristic of God to move the will, especially by inclining it from within, again, according to its nature. Well, I agree with that again. So how special is the special grace of salvation? How special is the regenerating grace? And what is its ordinary means? And when you get to the ordinary means, that's where the departure is going to become clear. Now, it should already be clear, because this distinction was not made. Alright? So as far as we know, and we're right to have the suspicion, all of this is going to be justifying grace. And that's the language that's used in Catholic baptism. Justifying grace is being poured in to the recipient. At this point, we have to add a second division of two kinds of grace. Prevenient grace and subsequent grace. So, the soul is not merely unrighteous, the soul is sick, it needs healing. So we're going to make a second distinction about grace, other than just operative and cooperative. And let me borrow from a chart that R.C. Sproul has in his book, Faith Alone. And here the lines don't mean what they usually mean, above the line, below the line. He's just trying to divide it into two. So I want to be as faithful to Sproul's diagram as possible. The two distinctions, one he's already made, operative versus cooperative. But since we want to really cement home this idea, let's write it out. Operative grace, God moves the human will the good. God moves the will to will
the good. Agreed, agreed,
sure. And then, cooperative grace means God moves the will to will the good, and the human will wills the good. And let's just put, and the will does. Okay? Now, the second distinction between prevenient grace and subsequent grace is this. Prevenient grace. God heals the human soul. We agree. Especially final glory. God heals the human soul. Subsequent grace. God heals the human soul, and the human soul wills the good. So the two are very closely associated with each other. This is just referring to its cause, this to its effect, its moral effect. So for Rome, justification is going to be a moral work. It is only later a legal work. Kind of like, who's that guy? N.T. Wright. Which means kind of like the Gospel Coalition, if they're not careful and they keep schmoozing with them. It takes grace to regenerate and heal. But once alive, God responds to our response. And doesn't the Scripture even say, James 4:8, draw near to me and I will draw near to you. So you see that wheel. So I'll give you this grace, but as you get that, you get more grace. Well, we agree there's means of grace. If I come to church, I get more grace in that sense. But that belongs to sanctification, not to justification. We have to remember, as we go through this, at every point, if a Catholic is careful, he will say something much more biblical than an evangelical. And you'll be forced to say, what was that fight over again? Because you have to remember that the controversy is over the means and the ground of justification. Throw that away for a second. The means, and therefore, the ground. Because if you have the wrong means, you will see very quickly, hopefully if you're a good student, that that's a different ground of justification. And therefore, it's actually causing grace. So, one more word, biblical word, to show this with, and that's faith. What relationship has faith with being declared righteous before God? Well, to Aquinas, it is a factor. But faith in this sense is merely assent along with cooperation. So let's put under means, assent and cooperate. And that what that comes to mean is, under assent, let's put faith, and then put dot, 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 under cooperate, works. Faith works. In fact, when they heard Luther, they heard him saying, faith alone, faith without works. Wait, faith without works is dead. That's what James says. And they pit James against Paul at that point. Of course, Luther never denied that. Calvin never denied that, that we have a living faith, a working faith, but the working belongs to sanctification, not to justification. That's the biblical distinction. So cooperative grace was destined to become meritorious grace. There could be no confusion. The most recent Catechism of the Catholic Church, published in 1994, reaches back into the language of the Council of Trent, which, remember, responded to the Reformers. And the Catechism is motivated at this point to make it sound as if cooperative grace is not a merit apart from grace. It says, quote, "The merits of our good works are gifts of the divine goodness. Our merits are God's gifts." Well, then they're not merits. Isn't gracious merit or meritorious grace a bit like a square circle? It's entirely like a square circle. Thomas's solution here is simply to see merit as a circle inside of God's grace at every point and not conflicting circles. But is that what Paul says in Romans 11:6? I don't think so. Now, if a Catholic would hear would say, you can't interpret that. You're not the Pope. Yeah, but you just said that a couple centuries ago, so what happened before that? While you're at it, what happened when you had three popes? While you're at it, what do you do when your pope is a child? Or a girl one time? Or married? But we won't go there. Romans 11:6. "But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace." So if by merit you mean what the word merit means, namely, by something, earning something. In other words, a ground, a moral cause, which is exactly what they mean. They cannot be going together. It's worse than oil and water. It is a square circle. That's Paul's point. You've got to choose one or the other. The key here is that righteousness or real merit in the Catholic system, in Thomas's thought here, had to really inhere in the one who would be justified. So grace had to precede everything in the nature, but it was a grace that was given precisely to give the Christian an inherent righteousness. This grace was given to give the believer a real righteousness in his own character. And so the link between infused righteousness, as opposed to imputed righteousness, that's the Reformed doctrine, but the link between infused righteousness at baptism, infusing it through baptism, and the Roman sacraments does not actually start with baptism. This idea starts with the assumption behind it. The assumption articulated by Aquinas that just as virtue is the perfecting of habit, so the work of Christ in us is purifying us of the bad habit, and the Spirit infusing in us good habits. In other words, the erroneous doctrines of man and Christ's work logically precede the erroneous doctrines of cooperative grace and infused righteousness. And the seven sacraments then follow from that devilish deduction. In other words, what we're saying is that you had to go in this with a fine-tooth comb to see it, but once you see it, like a rotting fruit or a rotting piece of wood, the rot is actually spread through the whole system. In other words, I'm not saying here, and I don't think R.C. Sproul is saying this either. A lot of times people come to the Reformed faith and they listen to R.C. Sproul while they're listening to other people, and they hear Sproul talk about Roman Catholicism in this very fine-tooth comb kind of a way, and they're saying, is he a Catholic sympathizer? No, but what he's saying to you is, you don't have to slander them, and you must not, because if you want to see where the real problem is, you got to go down in there, and then you will see that actually their doctrine of God and their doctrine of Christ is pretty corrupt too. But you can't just start by saying, well, the whole thing is wrong, because on the surface in the ecumenical creeds, we agree with them. You got to get down in there, into the root, into the core of the problem. And that brings up sacraments finally and quickly. Question 62, Article 1 of Part 3 of the Summa asks whether the sacraments are the cause of grace, to which Thomas answers in the affirmative. How on earth can he say this, you might be asking, without going back on grace preceding any of its means? These are means of grace, right? Well, his attempt is certainly ingenious. He makes yet another distinction, a last one. This one being between two agent causes, the principal and the instrumental. So he says, quote, the principal cause works by the power of its form, to which form the effect is likened, just as fire by its own heat makes something hot. In this way, none but God can cause grace, but the instrumental cause works not by the power of its form, but only by the motion whereby it is moved by the principal agent, so that the effect is not likened to the instrument, but to the principal agent. For instance, the couch is not like the axe, but like the art which is in the craftsman's mind. That's a funny analogy to begin with. It's like, is that how they made couches back then? You know. But this point of the analogy is simply that you have this primary cause, and you have the instrumental cause. We agree with that. We just think that faith alone is the instrumental cause that attaches justification. Our view comes from the Bible. As opposed to the instrumental cause being baptism. Now, is baptism an instrument of grace in the sense of a means of grace? Yes. So is, apparently, childbearing in some way. In some mysterious way, doesn't Paul say, to women. But women will be saved through childbearing. And doesn't Paul say to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4:16, keep a close watch on your life and on your doctrine. Persist in this, for by doing this, you will save both yourself and your hearers. Oh, keeping a close watch on my life and my doctrine saves people. Okay, those are instrumental or means of grace. So Thomas's distinction is not the problem. We agree that there are instrumental causes. Again, remember, what is the means? What is the means? And so the Reformers would say that justification is the material, or is it the formal, darn it? I think they said the material cause of the Reformation. Because what they're saying is at the core is what is the grounds? What's the stuff? What is the stuff that you're taking into heaven with you? And that gets right into who and what righteousness is it that the Christian has. Okay? So at the end of the day, all that this does is to give meritorious grace its dramatic form in the church, which goes by the Latin name ex opere operata. So does Thomas agree with Augustine against the Pelagians and semi-Pelagians that it is salvation by grace alone? On the surface, it would seem so. But it is a grace ex opere operata. Out of, or from, sorry, from the working of the works. From the working of the works. From? What do you mean from? That speaks of an origin. So, baptism, namely the church, as the dispenser of grace, is made the efficient, or at least part of, the efficient cause of grace. And when you say it like that, today's evangelical would probably show their true colors, in fact they do, and say, that is really nitpicky. To which I would respond, well then, the next time you're witnessing downtown or to your mother, just tell them they can choose the local Catholic diocese just as well as they can choose the Vineyard or Calvary Chapel or a Reformed Church or anything else, because that's already what you do. And is it any wonder? Well, more stuff to say here, but I think the application is pretty clear. And it's that same thesis of doctrine and division. Galatians 5:9. Little bit of leaven. Leaven's the whole lump. Which, when you see it, when you identify the leaven, makes you realize that Paul really does not mean that it was a little thing at all. Otherwise, the whole book of Galatians that he writes that in would be a little thing. Which is part of what the New Perspectives on Paul wants to say about the book of Galatians. That was purely a polemical work. And you can't define justification out from Paul's negative polemic against that particular problem in those churches. So when Paul says a little bit of leaven leavens the whole lump, he's not agreeing with the New Perspectives there to say that this is some little thing. On the surface, when you get in there, it's a little bit. But when you put it under the microscope, you find out that the DNA at that microscopic level is actually the traits of the whole body. And if a mad scientist goes in there and starts doing that, even at the littlest place, that's where the biggest errors come from. All right, so that's that. And I'll open it up to questions, comments, or anything else.
I've got a silly question, but I didn't quite write it down. What was the other, besides an excessive laughter, what was the other venial?
Oh, the example that he gave was laughter and idleness.
Idleness.
Yeah, like idle hands or, yeah. Yes, which means that nature, he is at least so, I would say that Aquinas, fair to say, that Aquinas unwittingly is a semi-Pelagian. Yeah. And that the Reformers' battle against Rome was not a battle against Pelagianism, but against semi-Pelagianism. Now, on one side of that coin, you might say, which is just Pelagianism in an unwitting form. Sure, I agree with that, but don't lose the other side of that coin. Because if you lose the other side of the coin, you'll miss this third circle that I drew up, which is that evangelicalism is in a worse place than the Roman Catholic Church was leading up to the 16th century. And we don't want to accept that. But when I show it and prove it that in every way, in fact, I've thought of writing a book before showing the analogy between everything Rome does and everything evangelicals do. Instead of a priest's confessional booth, it's a mirror. Instead of te absolvo, it's a 12-step program. It's you go down the line, but when you go down the line, you start to realize it's actually worse in evangelicalism. And we don't want to come face to face with that.
I think Slick fails to make that distinction.
Oh, yeah.
He rails against Romanism, but really gives a pass to even all of evangelical Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We are fully Pelagian, 80 to 90% according to polls in the evangelical church, and then the arms of that. See, we are anti-intellectual, anti-historic, and therefore I think anti-liturgical. And so when we look at Rome, we see this foreign thing culturally, and we mistake that for the problem. Why are we not Roman Catholic? Why did the reformers leave? In fact, I think Rob Bell even said it in one of his books that Luther was not leaving Rome over a doctrinal thing. He was leaving Rome over worship and how to do church. And it's like, okay, you got two problems there. A, you're wrong about your claim. B, the church stuff is an extension of the doctrinal stuff. Yeah.
Well, don't you end up, the cooperative, if you're talking about sanctification, then you're talking biblically.
Right.
And yes, we are being changed and made into something new and different.
Yeah.
But if you are saying that cooperative is leading to further your justification,
right,
you end up with your salvation
yeah.
is complete,
mm-hmm.
and then you end up with doctrines of purgatory
yeah.
or whatever.
And the treasury of merit, and both of those are good examples, because even the phrase that you used, furthering your justification, how do you further, how slanderous to Christ?
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things that when you do make shipwreck of your soul and have to go to penance, and the priest has to absolve you, and Luther said that the fact that there's a priest is not the problem. We are supposed to confess each other's sins, but the authority to take that authority to yourself to absolve people of their sins and to do it as a work of satisfaction. Okay, that's the problem right there with penance. But what's the ground of penance? It's the treasury of merit. What's the ground of the treasury of merit? Well, it is the work of Christ who purchased for us a treasury of merit. Now, what's the problem there? In the ground that is Christ's righteousness, there is not enough merit. But the lives of the holy saints and their death as martyrs, there's more than enough merit. Well, how is there more than enough merit in the life and death of the saints, but not enough merit in the blood of Christ? Well, that's messed up. When you start digging into it, and the rot, then you start... See, on the surface, they're a lot better than evangelicals in terms of grace. But as you start peeling down in there, it gets buggier and buggier as you go in there.
You see the spread. It's just like one dandelion.
Yeah.
Right. Let it alone.
Right.
And drive that, and all the little seeds blow across your lawn. Pretty soon, you have a whole field of dandelions.
Yeah.
So yeah. You can't leave that one little thing. Oh, it's just one little.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Big
yeah.
deal.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's unbiblical too.
Right.
The smallest transgression you have transgressed all because the same one who made the one law all the laws.
Sorry.
Well, that's really interesting. Another distinction that I see happening, because I actually grew up going to Catholic schools and different things, is that the venial sins and the mortal sins is that there's not only a defining down of sin, but more and more bigger sins get put into the venial category. So pretty soon, masturbation is a venial sin.
Yeah.
And then homosexuality is a venial sin.
And then adultery.
And just keep moving bigger things into that category.
Yeah.
So what are the wages of sin? Death?
Yeah, no.
So there's some that don't earn death, which is weird.
Yeah.
It's total relativism at the end of the day, because like even my mom, who's been married, I think four times, the Catholic Church, so now that she's going back to Rome, the Catholic Church is willing to send annulment letters to all of her previous marriages, the first of which she was married in the Catholic Church. And they're trying to make it. So my brother brought up a good point to my mom. She's like, does that mean we don't exist?
Yeah.